Today is November 8th, 2014, and this is Karen Brewster with Dave Klein. Starting over again, on a couple days ago when we tried this, the power went off on us, and we lost that part of the recording, so we'll start again sort of talking about what we've dubbed environmental philosophy, but I'm not sure that's the right term, but how people interact with their environment and the importance of conservation and preservation and wilderness, if we get that far.
Yeah, that's a good thing to start out, because it's environmental philosophy can mean different things to different people. I was fascinated when I was early, I guess, in my college development, undergraduate student. I was, and that part of it, you meet, get turned on when in their cultural relationships when you're, it's elementary school, especially when I lived in Vermont. Everybody you, the teachers and the students and the other people you might meet, and you didn't meet very many then because you were small, and it was during the Depression years, there was not a lot of socializing where meals were involved. But they all, it was Vermont people, we understood that most of the people in Vermont were farmers, but they weren't all, because they were small cities and towns, and our dad was on these jack-of-all-trades, and he was trained back in New York, and where he was born, a little bit of that focus was on engineering. And so he was a very broad person, and he's a very intelligent guy. Went through high school and became, at that era, too, the emphasis was on the young nation of the United States that was becoming a real nation in the world. And the impression of young people was, it's all we're bringing all this modern knowledge from Europe, engineering particularly knowledge. How could you build these fabulous bridges across rivers? One thing to build big churches and stuff, but bridges where you had to support vehicles going across, and they couldn't all be like the Roman aqueducts that were made out of stone without mortar. They were, steel was becoming important for construction and for bridges. Yeah, that was it. And it's just fascinating to an engineer to, then you could, with, if you had good math, and you knew how to angles and structures, and then you could calculate the loading depending upon the design and the materials. Well, that's what's done in modern architectural design for homes as well. Well, in the early days it was too, but you're limited when you didn't have reinforced concrete, for example. Mm-hmm. And so when you realize, some of those churches that built without any reinforced concrete, and they had, these, what they call them, standing buttresses, mm-hmm, outside to hold
the flying buttresses.
Flying buttresses. They would hold the stonework, mm-hmm, and even in an earthquake, it would keep it from falling down, in or out.
But so when you were a kid in Vermont, did that start influencing this environmental philosophy?
No, I wasn't, definitely not. I was grew up in close to nature there, and was loved nature, and part of it was, the grandfather had a farm with a lot of natural hardwoods, and had a sugar bush and apple orchard. It was an altered, human altered environment, but it was very rustic, and he had, when I knew him, he didn't have a vehicle. He had horses, and wagon. And he was at sort of the end of the road that had to be, he had about 2 miles to go to the closest little larger village, which wasn't very big, where there was a milk processing dairy. And he sold his milk there. When he first went there, I think they would come and pick up the milk. And after he milked, and he had to cool it, and he had a spring that ran through his basement, and they had a, then you could pump water up in the sink. So he was pretty lucky, and it was just beautiful water and cool, and they could cool the milk down in, put the milk can down in the basement in the pool to cool it right away, which you should do, and then they put the milk can out by the end of, in front of the house, close to the road, and the milk wagon or truck would come by, tank truck, and pick it up, or maybe just break up the cans and take it back to the dairy, and then they could pasteurize it. Although in the early days, it was pasteurization was just coming into realization, so it was, there were laws hadn't been passed yet to require pasteurization. They had just been passed, I think, when I was a few years old.
Mm-hmm.
And when it, for, of course, most mothers breastfed
right.
the babies, but if for some reason they couldn't, then they always heated the milk up first, hot enough to literally pasteurize it, then cooled it down and said warm, but so that it was safe for the newborn. Mm. Whereas a lot of adults and kids drank unpasteurized
milk. So back to, you know, I use the word environmental philosophy. What does that term mean to you?
Well, it's a very loose term that you mentioned before, that it includes a lot of things. It to me, it's as a generic term, it means the patterns of curiosity of how people lived with the environment in a reasonably compatible way. I mean, I wouldn't call I mean, you use a standard of the extreme poverty in ghettos and pollution as it's a standard. You say that as part of environmental philosophy, that that's what you try to, you want to avoid in a culture or society. But on the other hand, when we're a developing young country, and there was a big focus on industrialization and machinery and all kinds of energy and steam engines, of course, first, mm-hmm. there was little concern about, say, air pollution, and a little concern about pollution of waters. The assumption was, well, you didn't have water treatment plants, and so you just use the rivers.
Mm-hmm.
The rivers were important for energy production. They were dammed in places, and you know, in the early days, yeah, there was still fishing in them, but finally the pollution and early progressive people and politicians and governors and mayors would work for trying to keep these rivers clean so that they could be, you could use the water in the river if you didn't have other drinking water available. Or you wanted fish in there too, and you didn't want to lose that. And you wanted your city to be attractive in a safe place, not where diseases were present and easy. When, for example, when I recall as a child, when we had a a flood in the Connecticut River Valley because of excessive rain, apparently, and maybe snow melt-off. I don't recall the details. But then when the flooding occurred, of course, it floods the ghetto areas where people are living without adequate sanitation. And even then, they were probably using outhouses, and which wasn't too bad when there were a few people. But when you get flooding, you have all that human feces going into the river, and the worse of the environment, including agricultural farms and what, all going into the river. And then if it's it often affected the water in reservoirs and stuff that were maybe using the river water or close to them and using the river water for storing and holding it up high so it would flow down by gravity to the cities. Well, it's a good reason to reduce the pollution. But there was a tendency also to, like in other parts of the world, India, for example, where the rivers are the source of water and the source of disposing human waste and everything. And so the solution is, if there's a big river and there's enough flow, it's not that serious. Or in the edge of the sea, you figure, well, the sea will take care of it, which of course it will if there's not that many people living in a good given place. So it's how we humans in different parts of the world, in different cultures, use the environment. And then, of course, it's vastly different if you live in a hot area versus a cold area, like in the northern communities. It's vastly different if you have abundance of water year-round and you don't have to preserve water for irrigation, and you don't have to be careful about the water that can get polluted because you've got excess, and let's let it go out to sea and then it's diluted and it's not a problem. And you can argue that going out to sea, it's eventually fertilizing the sea as well, as long as it is, which is true, of course.
So that Connecticut River Valley flood you mentioned, did there end up being cholera or
diphtheria? There was an outbreak of diphtheria, and they had a drug, you could get a shot, and the big thing was for everybody, and we were living in Hartford, a city, mm-hmm. and so in order to get the shots, they wanted everybody to go to the bridge that went across the Connecticut River. In Hartford, there was one big stone bridge on pillars. And the reason they wanted you there is because they could still use that bridge and they could treat people on both sides of the river. And they didn't have they didn't have to go around, and you couldn't get around in other places because of flooding. So mm-hmm. It wasn't mandatory, but it was highly recommended. So, my dad was working, and so my mom took us kids, and we walked quite a bit of ways to get there because transportation wasn't very good with the flood. But we were able to walk on high ground and so it didn't have to go through water areas. And then we all got the shots. And of course, for us kids, we didn't like the idea of getting shots, but my mom and dad both, emphasized the importance that this is very serious. It could be worse, and many people are going to die. It's not just, not get the disease and you don't have it now. If you don't get the shots, you may not get it. But if you do, then you help to spread it around to other people. So it's not just for yourselves, it's for the whole community. And so they were good about explaining these things. And they also, there were debates, of course, because there were the Christian Scientists who didn't believe in these shots. And they were fairly strong there in New England at that time. And so I think they probably, you know, some Christian Scientists were convinced that, yeah, they should make an exception because this is a really exception situation.
So was there a massive outbreak or did the vaccinations help prevent it?
Oh, you can't draw that other conclusion one way or another, but there was a pretty good turnout of people, and it was felt by the government that there was not a massive outbreak.
Okay.
But there might not have been a massive outbreak.
You don't know that. That's true.
So, yeah.
Okay.
So, anyway.
Anyway, I just want to follow up on that. So, back to the environmental philosophy.
Okay. But this is kind of, you know, it's how people live with the environment. And that means, you know, what is the difference in, that's part of my fascination in different cultures. And you had these different cultures in the United States, but they're usually regional and you didn't travel into many of these other areas, like the South versus the North. And, you know, there are more diseases and some of them were health-related and food-related in the United States, which you started learning about those in New England schools, which would tell you about them, and you learn a little bit about, you know, some of these problems that were just the way people were used to living and they didn't want to change. Like, what is it, beriberi or something, that a parasite that you get from the ground by going barefoot all the time.
Oh.
And it's common in place. It's not common where you have hard winters. It's common in the South. And then there was, when I got into undergraduate work in college, and yeah, then I learned about, beginning to learn about food-related problems and diseases, such as the problem of eating white corn in the South or grits instead of yellow corn. Yellow corn had a vitamin that the white corn didn't have. And so a simple solution was to eat yellow corn. So in parts of the South where they normally used yellow corn and made what was grits, you know, they made it, ground it up, and you bake a cornmeal was important. So, you know, to get the people to change is really hard if it's traditional. And the white corn grew well, so does the yellow corn. And but in, you realize when I did get traveling, you realize that more and more about food is very cultural related. Like when we first went to with the kids to when I went to do the PhD work in Vancouver, Canada, where we'd been. My wife had relatives in Seattle, and we'd, to get to there, you'd go through Seattle to get to Vancouver, where I would spend the academic year there with the family. And yeah, there were some minor differences. And, you know, why were these differences? Well, some were that there's more influence of the British in the first place in Vancouver, but then there were some spillover from the prairies where there were a lot of Europeans from the eastern countries like Poland and Czechoslovakia and some of those places, whereas in the eastern part of Canada, it wasn't French speaking. It was more similar British influence, and like in New England. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you had the French and French Canadians, and they were French Canadians when school in Connecticut, in the city in Hartford, when we moved down there, and my brother and I were in elementary school and a big public school, when a neighborhood we had to walk through to get home was French Canadian, and they had their own church schools, Catholics, parochial schools, and realized, you know, this different people, and they still in the homes were speaking French, mm-hmm. but it wasn't the same as they spoke it in France, and then I realized, well, yeah, even New England, which you think is British influence, well, northern Aroostook County in Maine, where they grow a lot of baking potatoes, you know, the big potatoes like they grow in Idaho, the northern part of that, that's French speaking. And I didn't know that at first. And you learn about the places that you used to living in. And then the same was true of northern New York, north of Lake Champlain, and northern Vermont. Yeah, some of those communities are primarily French Canadian speaking. And
so you're saying how culture influences people's relationship to their environment?
Yeah. People adapt to the environment, and the environment adapts to the people in terms of how they use it. So if you go into Europe, say, but it's true, is true in the United States, only in space, so differently in the United States with the prairies and the western grazing lands, for example. Well, you knew that there was no way you could have the tremendous numbers of bison when the Western movement moved out and the colonists started occupying that area. And the natives were, you thought that it had been that way forever, that the natives with horses were excellent riding bareback, and they hunted these bison with horses. And at that stage, American history didn't put enough emphasis on the fact that those horses were introduced by the Spaniards. Yeah. Well, we like to think of ourselves, English, as a colonist, the first colonist. Well, it was exploiters' countries rather than colonizing countries, and that was the Spaniards and the French in the north coming in with the voyagers to get furs. Mm-hmm. Now, they got along, in the north, they got along, and they were dependent upon the native people. In the south, the Spaniards were out to mainly after gold and precious metals and precious stones. Initial exploitation, and it was sanctioned by the church initially. Whereas in the north, the threat to the colonies were that the French were working with the native people, and they were joined up, the natives joined up. They sometimes had wars and squabbles, but it was totally different. It wasn't over land usually. It was over how they harvested furs and things of that nature. And then when we had this Western movement, Thomas Jefferson, when he was president, and started and organized the Lewis and Clark expedition to the West Coast. That was to establish rights over, like a first claim, mm-hmm. when this was European countries, that was like the general attitude was, Spaniards as well, that at first you just killed any of the natives in Mexico and Central America that resisted their armies. And so you had to send a lot of Spaniards who were good warriors with horses, and they were able to overcome these well-developed cultures with high cultural development, mainly because they wanted to get the wealth. And then it was later then that they decided to settle, and because if they were going to have people there, they had to put them to work in the fields. And then of course, the church was having a rough time justifying looting countries, and a lot of the money was coming back to the church. Mm-hmm. People were being murdered and mistreated, and then the worst case, not intentionally, but the diseases were brought in by these people, and it was obvious that these whole cultures were being wiped out, native people, and of course, gradually the European common people with some education realized that this is a terrible thing that's going on, and let's soften it. Well, the way you soften it is you convert these people to be Christians, and then they were no longer savages, and they would. So we have to treat them more fairly. But then, once you convert them, then they're equal to us, and so then you try to do what's best for the country, not for the people. And and this is where, Jefferson was ahead of his times, but at the same time, he thought of these native people as separate countries or separate nations, and so his instructions to Lewis and Clark was, we can't accomplish this objective. But the objective is important from our relationship to the European countries, mainly Spain and France that owned Louisiana. But it was mainly in France and the North that, they were still coming from a threat from Canada because they were bringing in firearms to the natives, whereas in the attitude in the South was, trade firearms to the native people, and you can use any other techniques like alcohol and tobacco, which the Spaniards learned and discovered tobacco, and then they started growing it, and then the natives liked it. But they didn't use it in an addictive way initially. It was a ceremonial thing. At any rate, so all of these cultural things, the way the environment shapes people, but it's the same as evolution of organisms, especially mammals, say, and birds, that have the ability to move, but they go to habitats that are suitable for them to live in, and so they get dispersed around. Sometimes the habitat that they evolved in no longer exists, so sometimes they had to adapt. But evolutionary adaptation is a slow process, and sometimes populations would be forced to speciate or adapt evolutionarily. It's like the finches on the Galapagos Islands.
Way their beaks changed?
Yeah, in relationship to how they could exploit seeds and different food of different types. so they wouldn't all be competing for the same thing. And so, you know, the this, you know, Darwin enters the picture, but it was, he wasn't alone in having these difficult questions and how do you answer them. So environmental philosophy is tied to ecology, evolution and adaptation to environment, and then this question that underlies all of this is where, as humans, as so-called thinking animals, the term environmental philosophy is a human bias term.
Right.
How do we as humans, and people are educated and use that term, some of us who understand evolution and ecology, it's still a biased term, because if we say environmental philosophy is oriented toward protection of the natural environment, then you have to say, why protect the natural environment? Well, it really doesn't make any difference to humans or to the environment if humans aren't there as to how it's going to go. It's going to go in terms of what a natural way, and that could mean rising sea levels after the glaciers were receding and people had to move out of good habitat for them, for agriculture and what, and places like the British Isles become islands instead of connected to, and this is all during human history now, and so we realize that humans have adapted to the environment, but they also doing this as a group of people, and groups of people take group of people living together in one area to create a culture, or a culture develops in relationship to humans living that way. If there were just, we were all nomadic and had no bounds, which is could have been the case when the first humans were moving into mm-hmm. Europe from Africa or into the Americas from Eurasia. How did it settle out? And then once you get modern and yet civilization occurring and agriculture and domestication of animals, I mean, these were all people that were once hunters and gatherers and not used to being settled down in one location. But if you get land and producing agricultural crops, then you get the concept of land ownership or management of the land. If you destroy the land by overgrazing it or not fertilizing, and that happens in many areas, and so the areas that were naturally fertilized, like the Nile Valley, by flooding, I mean, you don't want to eliminate those floods. You learn to move out. And same is true of the people that lived in the lower Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers. These people lived on the rivers, except they moved out before the snowmelt and the rivers flooded into other areas where they were semi-nomadic, so they would move out in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, they'd hunt the waterfowl that were returning, they would trap furs, they would fish a little bit through the ice for things like pike and whitefish, but then they would also, after the breakup and the rivers went down, they'd go back to their villages, and then when the salmon were running, they would live on the rivers in relationship to harvesting salmon and preserving it, and they had to do all these things that were culturally related or stimulated by the environment, such as where do you put the dried salmon so bears are going to eat it, or the dogs, if you got using dogs for mm-hmm. traction, Yeah, and other smaller animals, wolverines. So you learn to build caches that bears can't get into, and you take the ladders down, and you put improvise with, once you get snow pipes, you use old snow piping to around so the squirrels and can't climb up the posts, or porcupines and things like that that would climb up there and damage your facilities and your food. So
what do you think has changed, and why humans now, instead of responding to flooding by moving out, we want to control it?
Well, it's because once you localize, and that partly started in the Middle East, probably with agriculture and crops, then you can have you can produce more than you need, and then you can have communities where people are trade, and they, you sell some of your crop to them, and then gradually that reverses, and if you get a, you have to have someone to protect your land when you're a small community, because other people might move in and take it away from you. Well, that's when the kingdoms and chieftains and the church were involved. So if they're going to have armies that protect your land, they certainly are justified in taxing you to pay for that. And maybe you pay it by so much of your crop you contribute to the king. And then they use that to sell and trade with other places if they can. And then, but they're also feeding their armies, mm-hmm. And paying, they have to pay their soldiers, et cetera, and feed them. And so, and then you'll have new developments. Like some of those you can work yourself, like in the Nile Valley. Well, initially when they started settling there, instead of being hunters and gatherers, then you cut down the trees too, so you, and turn it into a cropland. But what they do in the dry season, you get water out of the river. And how do you get it there? You carry it in buckets, and so you had to know how to make buckets and things initially. And it, you can do that in many ways. But then you can also maybe have water power. Or if you don't, on a big river that's slow moving, you can't do that. Well, then you devise some pumping system, which you get a treadmill sort of view, mm-hmm. and it picks up buckets of water and with on cables and a wheel at the top, wheel at the bottom, and a ladder, and you climb up to there, and you then you walk, and your weight will carry it down. And so, you know, this could be, you know, slaves could do this, you know, and so having labor. Instead of having engines, well, we didn't have the engines, steam engines or diesel pumps or windmills. But the windmills came pretty early on, because if you have the wind, then you can pump water. And of course, in early days of Holland, when they started reclaiming land from the sea by building dikes, you got to get rid of that water. And the windmills were all over the place. And you know, you have to be conscientious. You learn about engineering of building dikes to make them resistant. And of course, the worst thing you can have is things like muskrats that burrow into your dikes. Speed.
Well, it does seem like we as a society have shifted from living in accordance with what nature throws at us to us manipulating and trying to change nature.
Well, yes and no, but if you're living at a very low density, you're more, you have to live closer to nature, and you can harvest a lot of natural foods. That includes fish as well as food from the forests and land, and nuts and all the things that the early pioneering farmers used a lot of these supplemental foods, shot the deer that were coming and eating their crops, but then they managed the crops right. They could minimize this, but they could still shoot the deer. If the deer were living in, if you left hedgerows with food in the hedgerows. And so learning how to live with the environment in such a way that you benefit from it, humans benefit from it. And sort of like, you know, in the early days, there was no commercial fertilization. So, and you, farmers had horses and cattle, and the value of those for recycling vegetative material into fertilization was huge. If you're on a rangeland, well, all of the farmers with the cattle were out there, the rangeland replenished itself, unless grazing was too intense. And the same average farmer, dairy farmer back in New England, you incubated all that cow shit all winter long, and you you put it out on the fields, and in Denmark, I mean, it was so impressive that they've been, but more than any other country in the world, have maintained per capita production of food products for export much more than other places without using great quantities of fertilizer. They, you know, dairy farms over there, big farms, they had these, they saved all of the urine, and then they would put the had big storage tanks, usually made out of stone or concrete, and then in the springtime, after the snow melted, before you plowed, you went out with these tank trucks or wagons, and the motion would cause a sprinkler. You know, it dribble out, and then something sprinkled this urine from the cows, which is much more fertilizer. They used the solid waste as well, and had wagons in the early days that had a rotating gear because you pulled it with horses, and it scattered these the feces, which we use these kind of devices, and they were quite adaptable to being pulled by tractors as soon as we got tractors. And you know, Cramer's Field, you know, I remember they put that fertilizer out and during the snowmelt period, and that was part of what the birds were coming into. They didn't bait, but there was cows, you know, some of the grains go through whole and don't get digested, especially from horses. That happens a lot. And they pick it out. This is in New York City. They did so many pigeons, and before automobiles, pigeons, and introduced English sparrows and starlings. And they did a good job of helping to clean up mainly a horse shit there, because that was the main traction before automobiles. And there were just horses everywhere. And some of the, if they were kind of semi-farmers and had wagons, and they would, some of them would actually, the horse stopped and took a crap, they went back and picked it up. And if they didn't, maybe someone else would, but the pigeons would also work on it in a hurry. But it was, there were so many, it could be a problem, a health problem as well. And especially the more wealthy people said, this is terrible, you know, to have this so much smell of the horse shit, they got to clean it up regularly.
So then it became burning coal, and that polluted, and now we burn fossil fuels, and that pollutes.
Yeah. But even London, you know, they back in the early previous century, in 1910 or so, the coal was the main source of of energy for the city and for heating and all these little buildings and apartments had a little coal stove.
Yeah, it was terribly polluting.
And it wasn't so much that it was so terribly polluting as that in the wintertime the air is sort of like Fairbanks.
Right.
The air would hang around, and it, if they had a strong winds, they wouldn't notice it. And other cities were doing the same thing, but they were windy cities and didn't have a problem because of the mixing. And it was, the mixing is, dilution, and that's works fine up to a point until you start getting to the point that you're polluting the atmosphere globally, and it's having an impact back on the weather and other factors. So, it's not like people should have, we should have been doing things differently early on. Well, when you realize the advances in knowledge and education in England that was leading the world at the same time, and London was a hotspot, one of the hotspots, but leading the world and in commerce, and they were building better ships and everything. And the first, industrialization was going on. And of course, coal was what was doing it.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about now and living sustainably with the environment?
Pardon?
About us now trying to live sustainably with our environment. What do you think about that?
That I have a problem with using that term sustainably. It's sort of like ecology. When I started talking about ecology, it was sort of unique and people started thinking differently. But now it's, candy bars say ecological on it, and nobody has a clue as to what that means, and people, even in the universities, that they don't now. Science is to a lot of universities, I think, and this includes UAF. The ecology is not the core course in the sciences that it was before. Now, what it was more core is genetics and DNA, so we can better understand plant and animal populations, history, et cetera, through genetics, which is true, of course. We didn't have the techniques for doing that. And it's the same in England. Once the health problem of burning coal became overwhelming. And so finally they said, we've got to do something. So what did they do? Mainly what they did then was they coked the coal outside of the city, close to the mines. And then they brought the coke in with the railroad cars. And then they also could make natural gas out of the coal. Hmm. And they did that back in New England, that some of the cities like Boston and New York, they had this big gas there's a problem with that term gas that's been used in different ways. But if you look at the dictionary definition, it's a gaseous state of fuel, whereas gasoline is not the gaseous state.
No.
And it was like, and even in Europe, they frequently use the term petrol.
Right.
Because it refers more specifically, it's a newer term. Mm-hmm. But
sustainability, you have a problem with the term because it's sort of overused and not understood?
That's one problem, but the problem is it's not a simple problem. It's a complex problem. For example, you go, you see in the Newsminer, they interview people and say, what's your opinion of something?
Oh, yeah.
And
those
you get
man on the street.
The man on the street. Well, some of those are college-educated people. Some of them are students. And this is good. I mean, I like to read those because you tend to forget, you know, we know that the different political parties there, but we assume they're all the same. Well, it's similar. It's not that true. I mean, we have people coming in from Mexico and families, and they're gradually being acculturated to our culture here, which is very strange, and blacks the same way. Very strange. They can become just more like an educated white person than a lot of white people that don't have good education or came from the South and never, they don't think you need an education, and they don't realize how important it is for the kids to get an education. And one of the big reasons for needing an education, even if you're not worried about overpopulation, is that a change is occurring. And this is a Chamber of Commerce wants growth. They want growth. It's good for the economy. And so there's more workers, and more consumers, more good for the doctors giving birth to the kids in the hospitals, good for people that bury funeral people, more people that die, yeah, they do better. And so you've got to face the fact that people are living longer, but with more people, they all got to die. And so it's a good, secure business. When the economy goes bad, still people are dying and being born. More, they may slow down in an educated community and producing a young a little bit, but not much. And then you have the cross-section of the people, and you realize it's so strange. Even I remember one of the scientists I had great respect for worked for the Fish and Wildlife Service, I think. And he was really very well educated. He was a Mormon. And he rationalized, and we discussed sometimes religions, and he was very, you know, he understood and accepted evolution and all of that. And he'd think about problems too. And his whole attitude was the same as in third world countries, that, who's going to take care of older people? And people are living longer, and we're going to live longer, the moms and dads. And yet we haven't dealt with childhood diseases adequately, because at that stage there were more problems with things like measles and stuff that would often lead to death of a child. And we've helped out in that. But their attitude was, even though the average lifespan had increased markedly, this was back in the 60s and early 70s, and his statement was, well, let's face it, I mean, who's going to take care of us when the kids all grow up, and if they have good jobs, then okay. If we don't, if we just have a couple of kids and they die, and his attitude was, you know, he had four kids, I think, and he was planning on they were going to have another one, because the Mormons didn't really believe in birth control, mm-hmm. and they believed in you make more Mormons by having more kids. And yeah, that's a little legitimate way to approach it, and it seems pretty justified. And like some of the North African and Muslim areas, where the leader has a harem, and one man can father 100 and some mm-hmm. children, and they have the wealth to raise them well and educate them well, usually too. And And they don't have a lot of problems with women fighting with one another because they're all in there together and they don't have much of a voice anyway.
Right. They don't have any voice. Well, so do you see any ways we can get back to living more in accordance with the environment around us?
Of course, yeah. We have, you know, some examples, but also common sense. But it's common sense means you have to understand the environment in which you live better than we normally do. I mean, like, you know, where's most of the food coming that's feeding us and versus other people in the world as well? Well, a concept of free trade is a good one, but it's not in tune with the transportation costs. And it used to be, you know, we were able to make big advances in the days of sailing ships when it took a long time to bring bananas from the Central American countries into the U.S. market where they could be moved by trains to the markets. And bananas lend themselves to that. You pick them when they're green and they'll go on ripening. And you got to handle them with care. You don't want them bruised. But we can do all this. And we did that. And we did it with a lot of other things, too, that could be shipped that way. And especially things like fibers and wool, for example. You know, some places like New Zealand at one time were so wealthy because they produced so much wool when it was so important for clothing. Mm-hmm. And so they could export it, and it didn't make a difference if it took 2 months to get to Europe or the United States or 1 week. No point in having it come in a hurry as long as it keeps coming. The same with other things like silk and linen and what. But when we get hooked on, and of course, whaling was there for oil. And a lot of that was for not so much heating, but for lighting in the cities. And what did they use in other parts of the older world? They used olive oil. But if they had whales, they would have used sun. But they didn't have them. They didn't have the ships and capabilities. And then you know, the early days in the U.S., before petroleum, we used a lot of wood. And we use that for energy sometimes, and we could drive steam engines with it, and the early railroads used wood where it was available, like here when they had local mining railroads. That's why you see these old pictures, and this land is totally clear-cut. And you see these huge stacks of wood. And for Fairbanks, that was source of that. And, well, it made sense. We couldn't afford to have coal shipped in. Well, then when we got the railroad and the coal mine.
Well, and then we cut all the trees down, so we had to do something, right? Well, not all the trees, but we cut down many trees.
No, but we got to think, remember, there was a boom with gold mining that brought this about. But, it was mining coal. Well, it didn't make sense unless you had a way to get it to market. And well, with the railroad, that was. But we also we didn't use it that much for wood, moving wood around, until, partly because we had these big coastal forests where a lot of wood, and we could just cut that and the Japanese were happy to buy the logs until finally we made it illegal to buy worked logs, and then they just took a slab off of each one of these. Still shipped these big logs that were squared. It was unbelievable.
So where does the idea of wilderness come into all this?
Yeah, that's I was fascinated in this, and that is when I was became interested in humans and cultures and history, and that in the Middle Ages and some of the artists were depicting the cultured landscape was the most beautiful. And the early U.S. too, the cultured landscape was the desired thing. With the, even though it was pretty colonial, like the old covered bridges in New England, and then scattered farms and still forests and fields, and if you moved westward, then there was more of the land area was suitable for agriculture, so the forests decreased, unless it was not suitable, hilly country and not so suitable soils. But yeah, there was for a long time to me, and I felt that way too, a beautiful landscape, and the same in Scandinavia, was a cultured landscape with and that going to Sweden particularly, which without humans, it virtually all forested, and the central and northern would all be conifers. But of course, the Vikings and early peoples cleared land and started growing. And so that how the people lived then was fascinating to me. Did you go to the in you were in Oslo?
Mm-hmm.
Did you go to the old building museum, outdoor museum?
Yes.
So you can at those places, and there's a terrific one in Stockholm and other cities, and Copenhagen the same way. How these early people lived and use resources differently, and that was before, when they had domestic animals, and so they had again the fertilization, but then they harvested all kinds of things. They hired this scouring rush, equisetum, that grows in marsh, lake edges and marshes. They'd harvest that, and that was used to feed animals. In Iceland, when I was there and hiking into the mountains, studying the reindeer, the feral reindeer, and where sheeping, I was ranching up in the mountains, where this was in the northern part of Iceland, and it was related to studies of environmental impact of big dams. Well, some of this would flood some of the grazing areas for reindeer, and that was why I was there. But also there were sheep ranchers, and some of that would flood them. But when we went in the mountains, you would come across these old farmsteads up in the alpine habitat, alpine tundra. The only wood is willow that would grow along streams, and of course, very short growing season. These were the poorest people that were tried to have a place of their own, whereas in the early days when the Vikings were there, they brought a lot of women captives from Ireland, and they became additional wives for the chieftains had big land holdings because they got there early, and then the others that came were some of their families that came from Norway, and the chieftain had all this land And then they had an army when these other people came in, and they had to fight against others that right. were going for the land. So they all had, if you were, you didn't have the best land unless you were the chieftain. And that might include a salmon stream.
That would be the best.
Well, it did. In some places where there are salmon, that was the value of your land and the farmstead, and they would, you had a big army to protect yourself. But it was sort of a semi-democratic society, but mainly they would meet once a year, and people would come, and it was a flag of truce. When you came there, you didn't bring warriors or weapons, so sometimes they would be tempted to do that, and they settled up mainly crimes, mm-hmm. but also land and maybe it was a central government taxes. But a lot of the reasons for going there is one chieftain had gotten a dispute with the neighbor one, and they'd had a squabble, and there was a murder. And there was no law out there. And so there was kind of warlike. So they would come, and the family that had lost somebody through a murder, and that instead of having wars, they would come there and they'd present this before the assembly or legislature. The Alting was what it was called. And these were, you know, the powerful chieftains had representation there, but it was pretty democratic. And they brought families with them, and so they camped out, and big caravans coming, and they never had any wars there. And it was, so then the worst case scenario, if somebody committed a murder, they were exiled. And some of them went to Greenland. And that's what started. They were exiled because there was some kind of war, and it wasn't just a fair war, it was somebody murdered somebody else. And so it was a pretty good system, actually, for the time. But you got to realize this is true all over the world when these are first people coming. And so you got all these issues it's like there's no place like Alaska now. There's places that are similar, like we're being treated like Nigeria, where they have lots of oil, but the oil companies are paying off the leaders, and they're corrupt. And that doesn't filter down to the people. Mm-hmm. So, and that's something what we just had in this last election. I mean, there's a good letter to the editor today that said, in effect, he was just a good observer. He said he never thought, he's somebody that's lived here for quite a long time. It doesn't say what he did or what. And he says, raised his family and the good voter, he said he didn't realize we'd ever come to this position. He knew there was corruption at times, but for openly the outside money to buy the election, he said, this is no longer democracy, and I agree.
Right. Well, yeah, the way the oil industry bought the election during the primaries, that initiative on the oil tax, that was clearly the oil industry's bought that one.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, back sort of to this, I keep coming back to this environmental philosophy, trying to sort of triangulate what we mean by it and how to articulate it. And so I kind of start thinking about people like Aldo Leopold. And
okay, but then we sort of, we still have ground to cover, but one of the things I should have mentioned is that, you know, here when I was joining the faculty, you know, I was had a lot of these questions in my own mind, and I had never taken a course in philosophy. When I went back and did a PhD, I took one in philosophy at the University of British Columbia. But when I was a wildlife unit and had a bunch of students, and when I started, I wanted to have more discussion with students, graduate level students, about understanding the world we live in, and that includes, you know, harvests of wildlife resources, for example, but also sustainability, like, although I don't like the term, you know, managing resources in a responsible way, right, so you don't destroy them. Renewable resources, the term, means you should be able to continue to use them. And, of course, the early history of, the history before statehood was that, and I was working in Southeast Alaska at the time, was the salmon canneries were all Washington's and Oregon state interests, and they were involved in salmon there, and they just literally under the territory, they it was legal to build these fish traps and control the harvest of the fish. They created jobs for people, and a lot of them were native people, but for people to, not exclusively, to work in the canneries, good job for women. Mm-hmm. And men could fish, but they couldn't fish with their own boats. I mean, they could, but the canneries had control of these traps, and they wouldn't, you couldn't fish up on the rivers. And mm-hmm.
So over-harvesting like that happened is an example of not managing a resource in a renewable way.
No, that's more complex than that. And the hatcheries meant that the local people couldn't harvest and sell the stuff economically. They couldn't compete mm-hmm. with the canneries. And the canneries then offered them jobs with the tenders and stuff, so they could still do their boating, and they may own the boats, but they work for the canneries. It didn't pay to go out with to invest in a seine net mm-hmm. or a gill net and go out and catch and then market your fish. The only way you could do that is if you work for the cannery, and they wanted you to do that because that it didn't get them all. But it wasn't so much over-exploitation of the resources. It was use of the resources by one interest only. And they did frequently take too many salmon on rivers and knock down the run. Mm-hmm. But they didn't. It wasn't. It was primarily this. And with statehood, then first thing the state legislature did was to outlaw the canneries. Ooh, this had a big impact on a lot of people, and some of a lot of the native people at first, in some areas, it was the only income they had. They couldn't compete with the non-natives. But in the canneries that were close to the villages, and the natives, they were getting money and they were benefiting economically from these canneries. And the men didn't have the fishing boats, but it was places like Petersburg where they had, these were all Norwegian fishermen who came and settled. Mm-hmm. And they felt, and so did a lot of other communities, that we who are Alaskans should be able to catch the salmon. So in other words, open to entry rather than closed and selling it all to the to the canneries. So, I mean, if you sell it out to one company, just like the oil industry, I mean, they're going to monopolize the whole thing. And of course, there's been major changes in recent years, because then the canneries, that was really the only way you could market the fish, was to can it. And then it could be shipped all over the lower 48, or the world, for that matter. Mm-hmm. And so in the choicest resort restaurants down in around Yellowstone, for example, you know, look at the old menus. I mean, it was a big deal, and a lot of it was canned salmon.
Right.
Because they didn't have the refrigeration to get fresh salmon. Now, it's a minority almost. It's just the salmon canning.
Yeah. Well, you were starting to talk about wanting to have discussions with graduate students.
So I did. I organized this. First, I thought, well, we'll just have a discussion. And environmental philosophy in a biology wildlife program is, you don't just start teaching it. Plus, I was not a regular teacher. I was a federal employee and only expected to teach one graduate level course a year, which was fine. But I wanted to, you know, have something like a seminar, a non-credit discussion, which you have to be, it takes time, and students don't have too much time, and it's at the graduate level, because then maybe students would have time, because they're writing theses, or they would have, they're starting to get interested too in these issues. And so then I tried to do a one or two credit course, and I figured it's a kind of philosophy. So I talked with Walt Benisch and Rudy Krejci. They were the two philosophers in the philosophy department. And Walt, and I liked Walt, and I was one of the guys that were rocking the boat in terms of the faculty under Bill Wood, and Walt Benisch was one of them, so the two of us were kind of ringleaders, except that I was the one that could speak out more, because I wasn't under the salaried by the, but Wood had other ideas. He could get me transferred by complaining as president of the university, and he threatened that when I got involved in some of these issues. I was president of the, I was elected president of the National Association of Academic Professors, or something. It's a different title. But it was a national organization. And at that time, you know, there were a lot of the state-run schools didn't have, including those in the West and Alaska, there was no tenure, no sabbatical leaves, and you were on a contract for use. Here it was 2-year contract. That was like you could be a full professor and work your way up, and you're under a 2-year contract, and there was it was up to your dean to recommend whether you, if he didn't like you and you got in a squab, or she, it was he mostly then, and he could say, no, we're going to put you on probation, 1-year probation, unless you shape up, then you're out after 1 year. You couldn't just, if you were, had been around in under a 2-year contract and were a professor, even assistant or associate or full professor, they couldn't arbitrarily, well, they could fire you arbitrarily, but they had to be out more open on that. So at any rate, I was, you know, on the precursor to the Faculty Senate, which was because there was a growing unrest among the faculty, we wanted to have more of a voice in the governance of the university. Then we didn't thinking in terms of students having a voice, because the faculty didn't have a voice yet. And so finally Wood consented to having a faculty council, which was like a sandbox that he could say it was like he would bring an issue to them to discuss, and then we could make our recommendations to him. But or if an issue came up and we could discuss it, unless it was one that he said, no, it's already, we have the authority, as a dean has authority over the department head and the department head over the faculty, and then he has a final say himself. And that's what's the situation when Pruitt and Varick were involved in that. And at any rate, Walt wanted to stick to his philosophy. He had a lot of training in Eastern philosophy, and whereas Rudy Krejci, he'd come from originally from Czechoslovakia, and he was more traditional European philosophy, old philosophy, historical philosophy, and so. But both of them liked the idea. But the problem was they didn't have grad students then. And so Rudy said, yeah, I asked him if he'd be willing to join me and offer a course at the graduate level or upper division in graduate level, and be like a discussion, and we would be responsible for some introductory talks, but it would be try to be more like the Platonic discussions, mm-hmm. where you want much involvement with the students. So our job would be, mine and Rudy's would be, to sort of introduce topics. We'd pick topics so that we could focus on something that was of interest, and one might be the ethics of trapping, for example. And, you could do this at the University of Alaska, for sure. And there'll be interest. But we could talk about other things some of them related to the major conservation issues, like, say, Rampart Dam or something like that. But the focus, both of Rudy and I, were to try to keep it on a philosophical basis, and rather than being branded as environmentalists or no, we wanted to relate it to present issues, but I think birth control was one we did, but that was later when they were getting more females graduate students. But
that was one of the topics you discussed in the seminar, you mean?
Yeah, I usually would pick the topic, and Rudy would go along with it. And sometimes then I relied on Rudy to show how philosophies dealt with this in the past, especially ancient, like Greek and Roman. So he was a good authority, and he's a good lecturer. When I was high school, I thought ancient history, I mean, didn't have any interest whatsoever, but he was good, and I was brushing up, and I was doing some reading on my own on philosophy from time I was in, took a course there at UBC, and there were discussion groups there that I joined on. There were like evening discussion groups and non-credit things, and because it was a bigger university, and they were usually, they didn't call it environmental philosophy, it is a philosophical discussion, but and included the sciences. And there was one young scientist who actually started those groups, a young philosopher, and he wrote a book, a little pamphlet. That's one of the ones on something like rationality and religion, or something like that. Or this, and there were obviously, they taught, they had a theology section in a college down at UBC, and but this was not through them. It was in biological and physical sciences. So then it was obvious, because he'd ask, this guy would set up a panel and try to get someone from the biological sciences and someone from the physical sciences that that pretty much accepted modern views on the cosmos and and on what was not, but in terms of evolution, it was obvious that it wasn't as widely accepted by faculty members as he taught, and especially in the physical sciences. But there were good discussions, and most of the, even there were, I remember this one guy who was a physicist, and he was top notch, and but he was also pretty fundamentalist religion, and boy, he didn't do very well when, but he was, well, it's impossible to discuss religion as a faith when science is not a faith. Scientific methodology is not a faith at all. And some people, you know, tend to show it as a science versus religion versus a religious faith. That doesn't make sense. Because the Bible has got a lot of information in it, but it's observational information that of the time that it was written, but it's interpreted by people and written by people who are strong believers in Christianity and the. New Testament, at least, and then the published scientific findings, whether it's about the physical world or the biological world, it's there, it's subject to challenge if new information comes through, but theory, this whole question of what's a theory about, say, gravity, Is it a theory or not? Well, yeah, this is a theory, but it's also substantiated by experimentation. And so it's the same way with, I don't like this separating, say, traditional knowledge, native knowledge, traditional knowledge versus scientific knowledge. It doesn't make sense. Science is not a knowledge. It's... Knowledge is knowledge, and it can be good accepted knowledge. Some of it is observational, and some science methodology is observational. I mean, we can watch what's happening to the moon and gradually predict a lot of things that are happening up there, and that's true in the cosmos. And then draw hypotheses, and it proves out, because sun keeps coming up in the morning and going down at night, et cetera, et cetera. And traditional knowledge of natives is sort of is mostly all observational knowledge, although probably were some experimental stuff, but not very much. And it wasn't written down as such; it's passed on. But its knowledge is frequently traditional knowledge is frequently the best knowledge, because it is observational and the people were there close to what they were observing, not going out in the field and observing things for a week or two and then coming back. And traditional knowledge back in when I was a boy, you know, some of these old timers, farmers, and lived there and cleared some of the land, and that was traditional knowledge. But it was they had the advantage of melding it with modern, especially when it comes to things like technology. Mm-hmm. And the same was true to a limited extent, and to a greater extent now in indigenous knowledge. Because those people were accepting new technology. I mean, that's what archaeology shows, that, you know, the ability to produce, when you only have a few things you can work with before you had metal, depending on what kind of stones you had or could trade or get in some way or another. And these people developed skills that were culturally related, and made like this microblade technology. They were just chips of the really scarce flint, the best quality stuff, and obsidian, but mainly it was flint. When you can making a flint point, but all these little chips, then why not just use those? And that they made, you know, for arrow or spear, but spears first, and they would make grooves in the wood and then take pitch and glue these chips in. Well, it would like, they were sharper than razor blades.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, the problem with stone points on a spear, that you had to, and an animal, you had to be in close enough range that you could throw that spear and it still had velocity. It doesn't just hit and fall off.
Right.
And how can you do that? Well, you have to some way to propel it. Well, atlatl was a good way. In the sea, especially, you could be sitting in a kayak, and whereas if you're standing, like you're throwing a javelin, you can throw things further. But atlatl, it's lateral, and you don't have to, it's easy to keep it the right height to go from your kayak to a marine mammal, and it can get a big force. And once you didn't have to kill it. All you had to do is get that thing in, and the points were designed to stay in. Then you had your spear. Frequently, then you went closer and you threw a harpoon with a rope on it, and then you had the thing, even the big animal, then you could make the kill, etc. You had all the advantages. But and then some of the interesting stuff is archaeologically is these snow patches that are melting there, and mainly Yukon, a few in Alaska, but it's mostly in the Wrangells, and where they suddenly here's all this caribou shit where there's no caribou in recent times when in Yukon. And now there's so much information has come out of that. And they find things like the spears and atlatls and then arrows from bow and arrow. And so they could date all this stuff because it was, they could get accurate dates on the caribou poop. The wood, you know, you didn't know how many hundreds of years it was, if it was wood, in relationship to how they got it and how many long it had been used. And they would have, you know, for fleshing arrows, they'd have arrows or feathers cut from what the people could get, like swans or loons or other waterfowl, and usually, and so you get, and there's no decomposition. It was like it was in the freezer for up to 7,000 years old was the oldest they found, and that was bison shit down in northern British Columbia. In there, I don't think they found any human tools associated with that, but the 5,000 was common. And. And then they'd find occasional leather moccasin or even a leather pouch, which mm-hmm. they had some tools in or something. And but they'd find, you know, perfect spear from an atlatl that thrown and then went into the snow and you couldn't find it. And when you realize, you know, in the conditions, and especially if you miss and you're in a group, you don't go and recover that instantaneously because the animals may still be there and the others before they had bow and arrow. But then they could date all this stuff and show just when the bow and arrow was coming in, and it came when it came in, it has spread so rapidly. It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. So for environmental philosophy, do you have particular writers that inspired you? We've talked about Aldo Leopold in the past, but are there other ones who...
Aldo Leopold was one of the major ones because, you know, when I was taking undergraduate courses at the University of Connecticut, they had a good program in wildlife, which was in with the forestry department. And at the time, I decided I wasn't really, I didn't want to be a forester because I was more interested in animals, but I was more interested in diversity of botany. But I took forestry courses and I never regretted that. In fact, it gave me a feeling for soils. Forestry was more into soils than wildlife.
And well, Aldo Leopold influenced you from a scientific perspective, right? But did he influence you philosophically too?
Oh, I wouldn't say it. The problem is with wildlife management. He wrote this textbook when he was a professor at the mm-hmm. University of Wisconsin called Game Management.
Right.
And it was focusing on wildlife and how do you use the land along with using it for agriculture, mainly agriculture, but other uses in a compatible way with having suitable habitat. And one of the things that I appreciated most about his writing, well, his way of writing, and he, you know, he was able to express himself both as a scientist and as a philosopher. And that was very impressive to me as a young student. But also, it was a heavy emphasis, too, on habitat that I appreciated. And I had, in my undergraduate degree was in the, I think it was called in the Department of Plant Science, which included agriculture as well as forestry and wildlife. And I was interested in botany. And I took botany courses, and for electives I was interested also in gardening and the European gardening and mm-hmm. different times of the formal gardens versus the natural ones and or so-called natural and British, and so I took a course in horticulture, which put there at that university was that's a agriculture is a bit was a big and still is a big component of the university, and the horticulture was a combination of the plants that are used for landscaping and how the plants are used in landscaping. And that was fascinating to me because I was interested in the aesthetics of landscape architecture. And I was already starting to read some of the translated from the Japanese, their emphasis on gardens and using natural vegetation, but also manipulating it to put emphasis on, say, water and aquatic plants, and then the shapes of some of the trees, you know, mm-hmm. were especially pines were so important, and And when I finally got to Japan and was able to visit some of those places, I mean, it's such a beauty. And in some of the their architecture, too, is the most beautiful stuff for me was residential homes, wealthy homes that people could live so close to nature and with, of course, it was a different climate, with sliding walls, so they just kind of open out and you're part of the garden and it's part of nature. That living close to nature, and that's why I got focused right on, early on endemic architecture. When I came to Alaska, log cabins, you know, people built secure buildings for good for the cold weather, but they're made out of logs and they use sod roofs and they learned to do this all by hand. And then you realize, well, some of the old Russian buildings were made out of logs and better craftsmanship because they had a longer history of doing it, whereas Alaska people coming for mining, what coming from the States, that was new to them because they didn't, their culture was not the Siberian culture where, and of course the early Russians, you know, they did, it was like post and beam in some ways. They used wooden pegs and because metal was too expensive to get there.
Too hard to get. Well, before we were on the recorder, you had mentioned the influence of particular activities and events on sort of your environmental thinking. And you had mentioned that field course in Russia and Finland.
Another one was when I was on sabbatical in Norway, but even earlier, there was this Norwegian environmental philosopher, Arne Næss. You know about him?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a lucky coincidence in the timing of my being on sabbatical there. And the two sort of host professors that sponsored my being there, and then I applied for a Fulbright, and with their help, got it. And but they had both visited here, especially one of them. One of them was, they were both ecologists.
So one was Arne Næss?
No.
No, oh, these are different people.
He was a professor heading up the philosophy, he was the head of the philosophy department at the University of Oslo at the time.
Okay.
At that time, he had several graduate students, and that this is going to take time. Do you want to continue or not, or do it next time?
I'm thinking maybe we should do it next time.
Yeah, because this is an important one, and it led to some of my writing over there, and I then interaction with Arne Næss and his students, especially a couple of his graduate students, they saw him as a real mentor, but he was also an environmental activist.
Yes. Okay. Well, why don't we then start off next time?
Yeah, let's do that.
But I just wanted you to say a little bit more on that Russian-Finland field course and how that influenced, or do you want to do that next time?
This precedes that.
Okay, so you do all that next time?
I hope we can, because they both take a lot of time. The Norwegian thing, it comes up that it relates a little bit to this Odyssey of Aldo Leopold.
Mm-hmm. And Julianne Warren.
To Juliana.
Mm-hmm.
Julianne. How is it? Julian?
I don't know if Julianne or Julianne.
Julianne, yeah. Because she was, she had knew about me through the New York City University where they were coming from when they came up here. And the head of, this is just background, so I'll just go through it quickly that we can start and go through it again. But the key professor was a Norwegian, a guy who was, this is a he was a great grandson of the first industrialist that changed Oslo into an industrial city, and an important one for Norway. And Peter Anker, and I think it was his great grandfather who was this, who became the mayor of the city, and back in the early 1800s, I think. At any rate, so he had done his undergraduate work at the University of Oslo, and he was interested in history and somewhat in philosophy, but history of a lot of things that were environmentally related, including Norwegian government and resource use. And he was such a top-notch student, he got a fellowship and did a PhD at Harvard. He wrote a book that's over there, and it's an excellent book called Imperial Ecology.
And that's Peter Anker who wrote it?
Peter Anker, A-N-K-E-R. P-E-D-E-R, Peter. And it's an excellent book about how ecology came into being as a field of study. Hmm. And it's really complicated, but he's the kind of person, Norwegian, that could do it, whereas an Englishman or American who come from English origins would find it hard, because it was English botanists from the best universities, Cambridge and Oxford, that played a major role in all this. They were ahead of their times in understanding in England plants and their distribution as races of plant communities. And then they got into soils, and so they were breaking the ground for European emphasis on understanding. You know, a little bit was American forestry, started a little bit from mainly German forestry, but that they were influenced earlier on by the British ecologists, plant ecologists. But and then this peculiar connection was that this guy Jan Smuts, who was a South African general that defeated the British in the Boer War, he was a young down in the Natal province down near Cape Town, but it was a wine growing area. And very fundamentalist Dutch Huguenot people, Afrikaans kind of people, but they were the settlers. And he was very raised, and he had a real interest in church and church school, and of course it was all white then in that university. And he was such a promising, intelligent guy. He'd been convinced that he should become a preacher, but they thought he needed more education and abroad. So he came from a family that wasn't wealthy. They got put together enough funding to send him to England to study at Oxford and Cambridge, and then come back. And theology was what they wanted him to study, and what he said, he assumed that was what he wanted. And, but he was a brilliant guy, and he started seeing the connection between plant ecology and African natural environments, and he literally was weaned into becoming a scientist, an environmental kind of scientist. But he had tremendous curiosity. But when he went back to South Africa, well, he is no longer headed the theological pathway. He was still, you know, practicing theologian or supposedly, but he was all into learning as much as you can about the environment, and he began to be interested in native people that grew up with that environment. And he realized that the native people need more education. He was able to improve some of the agricultural activities with his knowledge he gained in the soil characteristics, and he became fascinated in the variation in soils and how that resulted in different kind of environments, different kind of habitats. And then he realized that, if you take a look at Africa as at least southern Africa as a whole unit, I mean, the peoples are living in different kind of habitats too.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are savanna, dry, and some of them are really high veld, and some of them down in the more tropical, wet areas. And so he was a man really, really way ahead of his times.
Mm-hmm.
Well, South African Afrikaans government had a falling out, or peoples, they didn't want to be ruled by the English. And it was the English that were ruling.
Hmm.
And so they went to war. It wasn't, the blacks were not involved in
no.
it. And
that's the Boer War.
Yeah. So he was trained in military, had military training too in England. But he was a brilliant guy, and he put together this army of less well-trained, in theory, Afrikaans people. These were the settlers that came with their wagons, and farmers mostly. And they had slaves, but they also learned all these skills and had cavalry and had horses. And you had to be a good hunter too. And they were excellent hunters and marksmen, and so he put together this army, and the British sent their well-trained troops down there. And at first, you know, it looked like the British would clobber him right away, but he didn't. He had loyalty to England, because that's where he got this great education. He had high respect for them,
mm-hmm.
but it was his homeland. Then he thought it was his. And because these were the people that went there, not the British. They came later, and they were minorities, but they were knew more about government than the Afrikaans people. And of course, the most of the people, he was forward thinker, so that he wasn't down on the blacks like many of the Afrikaans farmers were, because they had problems sometimes with the local tribes would rise up and create problems, so that they could fight them too if they had to. But this was the British, and so at any rate, they defeated his leadership. And the British were overwhelmed that he was such a leader, and they also knew that he was trained by the British.
Mm.
So he knew the weaknesses and strengths, and so then he was elected president of the new government, the Afrikaans government. And he put a big emphasis on educating the blacks. His whole attitude was, these people have to learn how to live off the land, and they have to do a better job with agriculture than they're doing now. And we can help them, but we have to train them. And so we want them to get schooling and at the university level too. And so he started this program, but they were not ready yet to take over control. And of course, he didn't talk about that when he was the president. But that's what he had written about earlier on and talked about earlier before the war. And so then, he knew that and spoke openly about the blacks being inferior, but he said they're inferior only in their education. And that means cultural education and everything. So he thought, you know, in the future, then this land could be support the people better, everybody better, if they know how to use the land better and manage it better. But he was thinking of terms of areas that would be better if they weren't turned to agriculture, but we got to manage those wildlife areas in a better way, too, so that you don't over-harvest. And so, of course, the population levels were lower than they are now. But at any rate, then came he created these new universities, Johannesburg, Pretoria, and Witwatersrand or something.
Cape Town.
Cape Town was way ahead because they were already mixed with sailing peoples and mixed blood, and they were considered almost different people, colored people, rather than blacks.
Right.
But we wouldn't have to go into all this when we just because it's history books, and we're not rewriting history books.
No.
But then when the Second World War came, and Hitler came to power, Hitler thought, he recognizes that the blacks are inferior, so he's the kind of racist we want to work with, and he was originally from the Afrikaans people were from Holland, and their language was not too far from German, and then Germany had Namibia was the one colony they had, which was mostly desert, but had where all the diamonds were, they hadn't discovered all these diamonds at that time, and so. The Allies, Jan Smuts he wanted to join up with the Allies and be a general, because he was such a good general that he wanted to be a general and fight the Nazis in Europe. And the Allies, and this is Roosevelt
Churchill?
Britain at the time.
Winston Churchill.
Yeah, Churchill. Mainly those two said, no, the Nazis will go down there and take up all of South Africa, and that's going to be a major problem. And then they will, because they're going to move into the northern Africa, the Nazis with their armies, and if they come from the south, it's going to be just complicate things. And especially if he has their potential armies down there to help him, and they can take over other countries very easily. And so they said, Roosevelt and Chamberlain said, we need him to be there in South Africa and join us, the Allies, and then take over the German colony, which was not too difficult, but it would have, if the Germans were able to build bases there, naval bases and what, it would have complicated the whole thing. And so he was convinced that he would stay there and do that and remain president.
Okay.
And then he had to change his tone, though, and, because he didn't want to. He tried to say more, even more neutral about the difference between blacks and whites, and so they wouldn't be confused by the Nazis by saying, "Well, it's they're a bunch of racists like us," or something, right. Or in different words.
Right. Well, I
and
think
they did have. They respected in the government. They had some Jews that they respected in South Africa, and they respected the English as well, because these are people that were in this, they considered their home too, and they had the long. The British were, of course, later the British were more proactive in trying to get rid of the nationalists and bring a vote to the. To the blacks. The Jews, one or two Jews, and one was a woman. She was one of the most outstanding legislator in our members of their Congress or whatever it was. And she was respected by everybody, the blacks as well as the Afrikaners and others, just because she was so damn intelligent and broad-looking and respect for everybody and about, you know, let's work for the best long-term interest. But, so, and I, after reading this, and I was really impressed with Peter Anker. And then he went and dug into the history of the environmental movement in Norway.
Mm-hmm.
And published on that.
Yeah, you shared some of that with me before, right.
So, and I did meet him when I was over there in 2008, and I had, I was over there for, in February, and I talked at this institute, which was created by Brundtland, the woman Premier of Norway, who was very popular and an environmentalist. And she, Arne Næss by now is retired and getting old, but she created this institute within the University of Oslo. And it was something like, this is after oil. They became oil wealthy, mm-hmm. And they gave him Arne Næss sort of like a senior status there. He had married a Chinese woman, and his health is failing, and he was getting senile, and so he wasn't writing anymore. But and this woman was sort of looking after him and representing his interests to some extent. But they were. It was a graduate. Like a graduate, it's part of the university, but it was focusing on development in the environment, I think it was, mm-hmm. if you translated it. And they were doing, they had funding for some scholarships international. So they were bringing young people in from all over the world. And when I went over there, I was focusing on the attitudes towards climate change, but I wanted to be based there because I'd heard about it, and I corresponded, and they said, yeah, they could have an office for me, and that worked out fine. I was only there for a month, and then I went to Portugal for 3 weeks after that, which was part of it. But I had a chance to have lunch with Peter Anker at that time. He was busy as a postdoc, and he was, he had married an American woman from New York City, and she did not want to be, he could have gotten a faculty position in Norway. If he helped, it would have taken time, but he'd have to wait for retirement. And he would have been happy to do that. But he also figured he would be happy in the United States or Canada as well, or in England. Mm-hmm. And so he realized that she, they married and wanted to have a family, but New York City was sort of idyllic. That's where her, she had family, and she wanted to stay there. And he, I think he met her when she was at Harvard as a student there. And so he was looking, what he was looking for is a tenure track position, mm-hmm. because he was getting a pittance for what he was doing. And he was already getting, writing a lot of other books, and they were all kind of unique in many ways. I haven't read a lot of his stuff, but it's just a, he sees things in the, how do we interpret this in terms of the people and that are there now. And so we think a lot alike, but he's not trained as a biologist as I am. He's trained more as a historian and a writer, but he has good understanding of these things. So it's I sort of keep in touch with him a little bit, and I tried to get him up here on a postdoc earlier, and I thought he'd be just a great guy. And I talked to Terrence Cole about this, mm-hmm. and he said, yeah, that's a good idea, but, you know, I needed someone to fall through. I said, if we could get him here, and then the university could, he could do the history of the Scandinavian, especially Norwegian, effect on the university, and then go through all of these exchanges that we've had more recently and write it up. And he would be interested in doing that. And but it could include, you know, the pieces like people like Arne Næss, and that came. He didn't come to the university here, but he was. He spent time at California University on a sabbatical.
Berkeley.
No, it was one further south.
UCLA, maybe.
No, it was University of California at one of the. That wasn't. It wasn't Stanford, and but it was a University of California system, and he spent a sabbatical year there, and mm-hmm. he was writing some of that, and he visited other universities and gave lectures. And at any rate, but we can go into the details of my interaction with him.
Right. Well, I think next time we'll go into, we'll finish up some of this, where your environmental thinking has come from and how it's developed in certain periods in your life.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.